Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
Approximately 500,000 Australian women have reported that they've experienced physical or sexual violence or assault in the past 12 months alone. More than 1 million women have experienced physical or sexual assault by a male current or ex-partner at some point since the age of 15. But here's the really telling, concerning statistic. 80% of women say they'd be unlikely to even report abuse in their own lives should they encounter it. Tracy Howe is the CEO of Domestic Violence New South Wales. Tracy, thank you for joining us on Open House. Yours is one of many groups there to support women in their decision to leave an abusive relationship, either alone or with their children. How did your group begin?
Yes, the history of who we are was the women's refuge movement back in the 70s. So my organisation started the first women's refuge in Glebe in Sydney, and that grew into a network across New South Wales and obviously across Australia. And from that, we have evolved to provide more than just crisis accommodation, but other support to women and their children who need to get out of a violent relationship. And that's not just a bed for the night, but it's about supporting women who are still in their homes or with other options around what they might want to do to get someone out of the home who perpetrates violence or to find them new accommodation. So we've evolved from a shelter in 1974 in Glebe to a huge network of complex domestic and family violence services. And that's why we're not the Women's Refuge Movement now, we're Domestic Violence New South Wales, to reflect the breadth of the work that we do.
The figures around domestic violence are frankly horrifying. Approximately 500,000 Australian women have reported that they've experienced physical or sexual abuse in the past 12 months, but the vast majority of women have said that they haven't or would be unlikely to report such abuse. So we're talking about a group of people who are largely unseen, living in a very isolated, lonely place, feeling like they have no option.
That's right, Dwayne. And I think what is important to note is that the statistics are always alarming, particularly those homicide statistics, but they are always the tip of the iceberg for what's actually happening out there in the homes. Now, with Domestic Violence New South Wales and the services who are our members, we see that the largest portion of the women who we work with are living in situations where they seek advice because of power and control that's being exerted over them that is very often not about a physical abuse situation. And so we actually see that it's that mental abuse, the degradation of your self-esteem and taking your power away, stopping you having access to your vehicle, visiting family. All of those things that are chipped away that aren't put in that physical violent box. And so it's really hard for you to even think, I'm in a violent relationship. And yet when you look at the intimate partner homicides, very often those are the very men who commit the acts of murder where there hasn't been physical abuse before. So it says that the violence that takes your power away, that the mental abuse is just as alarming and worrisome as physical violence, because physical violence, we know what to do with it.
Perhaps we need to look at the way we understand the term abuse. It's got its roots in domination, doesn't it?
Power and control, you've got it spot on, Dwayne. And I think that's the thing in a healthy relationship, regardless of the gender of the couple, you know, it might be two women, two men, or a man and a woman, you want, whatever it is, there has to be an equality within that relationship. There's give and take, that one doesn't have to walk on eggshells or feel that they are somehow subservient to the other, and it is really about equality and partnership. And that is what is missing in violent relationships or abusive relationships. And it doesn't have to be physical. You absolutely nailed it when you mentioned that before. As soon as you see a woman who is always anxious because, oh, you know, if I don't keep the kids quiet, he'll just go off. I've got to make sure that everything is just so. He hates when I spend money on shoes. You know, all this worry around the feelings of another person because they may explode and blow up. Then you're seeing someone who potentially lives in a place of being disempowered and abused. That's not to say that couples don't argue or whatever. That's not the issue. The issue is when one has more power over the other. I'm not trying to be alarmist and say bickering between couples is the issue.
Yeah.
It's about being disempowered.
There are a bunch of common excuses around those who dominate or abuse their partners. If we hear these in conversation, what are we to do about them? Let's start with what we may overhear and then, in turn, what our response should be.
Yeah, well, one of the things that we are pushing at the moment is a no-excuse campaign, and it's based on just what you say. When we read any awful commentary around murders of women and their children, if you look in the comment section, the kinds of excuses you read are, well, he was going through a family law matter and that's awful. She lost, he lost everything. He wasn't allowed to see his kids. Women are abusers too. All of these things come up to rationalize the behavior and excuse it. These are warped excuses. They're not acceptable. And I like to liken it to my experience of living in the Blue Mountains, where we had bushfires that ripped through Winmalee. Mm. Those fires took out houses and all the possessions of some people who didn't have insurance. They have nothing. But it was never an excuse for them to lash out or do anything to those around them. And it's the same thing here. There was never an excuse to use your children or your partner to have that explosive episode on and use your power against. There is no excuse. Even if you lose everything, it's not an excuse. And I suppose that's what we have to say. We have to have a no tolerance. You know, the bar should be so high. You do not do this. You do not degrade women. You do not control women. It's never okay.
There will be those listening around the country through Open House Around Australia who aren't perhaps in New South Wales and able to contact Domestic Violence New South Wales, but
yes,
the rules are still the same. It is never okay. So then the obvious question is, what next? I've got two children that are depending on me. Perhaps I don't have a job. Where do I go?
Well, there's the for a start, you can call 1-800-RESPECT for advice, which is a national number. Most states have their own version of a domestic violence hotline. For example, in New South Wales, we have a domestic violence line, and in your state, you would have the same. I would encourage women to go to their local library or a place where they can have privacy to research on the internet what is in their district. I would also encourage women to just make that first gesture to someone like a doctor, a relative, a friend, to just start the conversation, and then they can start to make a plan around what they need to do, because it's as soon as the conversation starts and you free yourself from the sense that you want to keep this a secret, that you can start to make real change and you can start to make a plan for the safety of you and your children. There are many service systems out there across Australia that are there just to support you and who are specialists in this work, but sometimes it's your closest friend or your mum who'll be the one that can be the key. Someone in your church, certainly go talk to your minister. Talk to someone, get the conversation going. You have to remember this happens to every woman. You are not a weak person. You don't deserve this. There are women like Nigella Lawson, who's a millionaire, who is subject to abuse from her partner. So don't ever think that you are less or you're someone who deserves this. This is something that happens to all women, and you are absolutely entitled to equality. And, you know, Christians are all about gender equality, treating women well. It is not appropriate. There's no religious excuse for this. Good marriages happen in Christian households where women and men have their roles and equality and gender parity, and you're entitled to that.
Tracy, thank you for your time and the reminder that for too long perhaps we've ill-defined the term domestic violence, and it's not just about physical abuse. There's so much more going on in our homes around the country, and that if we know or sense that somebody might be in one of these relationships, to come alongside as a friend, as a family member perhaps, and let them know that they don't deserve this kind of treatment. Nobody does.
I think that's a powerful message, Dwayne, and I really hope that this starts the conversations going with the people who are listening to your show, because that's where it starts to change, and it's about men and women standing together and looking at the mentors who are good role models as husbands and partners and saying, this is what I aspire to. I think it's all about not just the government stepping in and supporting, but the community response, the church's response, that everyone says, this is how we have the bar set for relationships. I think it's a very powerful message.
Tracy Howe from Domestic Violence New South Wales, and their website dvnsw.org.au is a fantastic resource. Now that we've perhaps redefined what domestic abuse looks like, let's explore life inside an abusive home. In her blog, 7 Years Single Mummy, Kylie has posted a moving response to one of the most asked questions of any woman living in a violent relationship. Why don't you just leave? Kylie, thank you for joining us in Open House. You actually didn't recognise your relationship as an abusive one, did you? You did leave, however. Did family and friends ever ask you that question to your face?
Yeah, sure. So, look, my experience with domestic violence started quite early on in our relationship. And I had moved to his hometown not long after completing high school to do some study. And it was about halfway through this course that I actually met this man, and, you know, I thought, gosh, isn't he fantastic? He's confident and gregarious, and, you know, he's taking an interest in me. So the progression of our relationship actually moved quite quickly, and it was around that time that we moved in together, and my friends, you know, we had finished our study, so they were moving on with their careers or going back to their hometown. So that isolation from my friends and my family happened very quickly. The first time that he hit me, it was about 6 months after we were married, and I remember, you know, we'd been to a party and we got home that evening, and I remember thinking, when he hit me, I remember thinking, gosh, I know that's not right, but I also justified his movements and his actions, and I thought, well, gosh, maybe I had flirted with this man, or maybe I had drunk too much, and maybe I had embarrassed him. And at that stage, I vowed to try and be a better wife, and from that time it escalated in intensity, and, you know, his actions were very controlling and very, very, you know, he needed to know everything that I was doing all the time. He would belittle me in front of other people and put me down, and you know, along the road you lose yourself, you lose your confidence, and you lose who you are as a person, and that happens over a long period of time. But for me, I guess as the physical violence increased, and that was around the time when I started questioning, gosh, you know, this doesn't feel right, this isn't what other people's marriages look like, and I was kind of thinking, yeah, look, something's going on here, but I couldn't quite put my finger on it. And the couple of times that I tried to speak to him about, what's going on here, and sometimes, you know, I'd suggest marriage counselling or some kind of help, and he would just shut me down and, you know, tell me that I was being a hypochondriac and you know, just to, everything was fine. And, yeah, so it was around this time that I started questioning that the physical abuse for me really increased and intensified. And this was after, you know, eight years of marriage. Mm-hmm. So it's a very gradual process.
By this point, Kylie, how often were you being physically abused by your husband?
Yeah, any time that we would go to a social event, so, you know, sometimes we'd go to the pub on a Friday night to meet friends, or we'd go to the races. He had quite, you know, a high-profile job, so we were very often out within the community doing things. Mm-hmm. So very much after any of these events, it was likely that some form of physical or emotional or psychological abuse would be happening.
You were a mum by this time, well and truly, weren't you?
Oh, yes, yeah, look, absolutely. We, yes, had two young children at this stage, and, you know, there were times when, you know, that night that he had actually punched the wall, he broke a bone in his hand, so he had to go to hospital. And I just remember trying to fix the wall, you know, putting posters or pictures or anything that I could find over the wall so that when my children woke up the next morning, they wouldn't see what had happened. And I spent a lot of time doing that. You know, I removed doors from their hinges and covered any proof that what had happened, you know, I just tried to cover it over.
We've spoken already in today's discussion about the subtlety of abuse. You mentioned he was a lovely bloke before you got married. Looking back, though, do you recognise a sense of domination and an intent, perhaps some sort of foreboding warning that something was on the way? Or did it really only make an impact on you when he hit you that first time 6 months into your relationship?
Oh gosh, no! I can so clearly see those traits of his personality that you know so clearly evident to me now. But at the time, you don't realise. You think that by him being controlled, you know, wanting to know where you are all the time, you think, gosh, that's just because he cares about me and loves me, and yeah, you at the time you can't actually see how severe it actually is. And you're absolutely right, the emotional abuse is often quite, for me it was worse than the physical abuse. It took me so much longer to heal from those emotional torrents that he would, you know, say to me and constantly put me down. And that took a lot longer to heal from than the actual physical abuse.
Kylie, take me to the time where enough was enough and you left.
For me, you know, I had tried to leave for probably the previous 12 months, and he would say to me, you know, who's going to love you, and no one will love you as much as I do. And eventually it would go to, fine, you leave, but you're not taking my children. And at that stage, I didn't know where to go for help. I didn't know how to get out of this volatile situation. I knew at that stage it was wrong, but I didn't know the next step. So the final straw for me was, one night he put his hands around my throat and he squeezed very, very tightly. And I just remember looking at him and pleading with him through my eyes, just thinking, just stop, just let go. And why are you doing this to our family? What, you know, just leave me alone. And he let go. And he turned to go inside, and I just knew at that stage, I just said to myself, okay, girl, you've got to get out of here. We were out on the back deck, and I just turned and I ran. And it was, you know, it was something like 2 o'clock in the morning, and I didn't have my phone or my wallet, and I don't think I even had shoes on. And I just fled. I've never run so fast in my life. And I didn't know where I was running to, but I just had to get out of there. And as I was running, the car lights would be coming up behind me, and I thought to myself, gosh, he's coming in the car and he's going to run me over, he's going to kill me. And so every time car lights came, I would hide behind a bush or a tree or whatever I could find. And I honestly thought that he would kill me, and I've never felt so much fear in all of my life. And I ended up that night going to the police station and making a statement, and I took out an AVO on my husband, and he was arrested. And so I remember, carrying my children, my sleeping children, out of the house at, some 3:30 in the morning, and the police lights were flashing, and I looked down at their little faces, and I just thought, oh gosh, how did I get to this place? How did this happen, to me? And I just knew at that point that my life was never going to be the same again.
You mentioned that the advertising campaigns and so forth around domestic violence didn't really touch you for many years after you left that situation. How can we communicate what domestic violence is better and what to do if you're caught up in that web right now?
Yeah, look, good point. I think it's really important that we as a community start having that dialogue around domestic violence and really talking about it at work, within our social networks, having those conversations about what domestic violence might look like. And it's not always, that horrendous abuse that we so frequently associate with domestic violence. It is the little things. So I think, I know DV New South Wales, with their latest campaign, are really focusing on that, the things that he says or his actions, and it's not so much that, the abuse, the really shocking abuse.
Your life is now vastly different, isn't it, Kylie? You've achieved a bachelor's degree in early education. You've volunteered at an orphanage overseas. You still share custody with your ex-husband. What kind of place are you in now, 8 years after you left?
Oh, look, I look back now and I think it just feels like a completely different life that I'm living. I am a completely different person. And I've done things that I never thought would be possible, that he told me that I would never achieve. Having to co-parent with him has been probably, the most difficult.
Yeah,
the most difficult thing to do. And, that came about just after we separated. John Howard implemented the new shared parenting laws, and so that came about that way, and that's been really tough for me to deal with. But in saying that, I have achieved all these amazingly wonderful things that I'm really proud of, and I suppose more than anything, it's that self-respect that's come back, and that self-belief that I am valuable and I am viable and worthwhile.
Is there anything we can do from an outsider's perspective, from family and friends, to get through to somebody who's caught up in that dark, deep isolation that domestic abuse is, to get that message through earlier?
Definitely. I think it's so important, as a bystander or as a family or friend member, if you're witnessing behaviours that aren't acceptable, I think it's time that we stand up and, start saying, don't talk to her that way, or don't treat that, that's not right. So often for me, I remember thinking, gosh, no one else is saying anything, so it must be okay what he's doing. So it's really about taking that time to, just standing up for other people's rights. But the other really important thing, I think, is taking note of other people, you know, really asking how you're going, what's going on in your life. And for me, so much of my healing came about from having these really nice interactions with people, just with the general public. You know, I'm lucky that we live in quite a small, close-knit community, and people were genuinely concerned for my well-being, and some days that's what got me through. So it's just about, you know, really taking the time to connect with, you know, your colleagues or people that live within your community context.
Kylie, it's been brilliant to meet and talk with you. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
To read Kylie's blog, head to 7yearssinglemummy.blogspot.com.au. A word of warning, though, there are some very adult concepts there, and some of the language is at times quite confronting. What if we could head off those destructive behaviours in our kids before they become husbands and wives? Find better ways of dealing with anger and frustration. School principal Rob Jennings and his staff have done just that. G'day Rob, welcome to Open House. Your school community has seen some incredible changes since you kicked off the White Ribbon Schools program, haven't they? Give us a before and after snapshot of your school.
Okay, Dwayne. The school today is a much calmer place. The playground environment, the classroom environment is much calmer. Teaching is happening. The teachers are able to teach and do what they have to do on a daily basis. The children are here to learn. A few years ago, it was very different, and there was aggression in the playground. There were student welfare behaviours and incidents that were preventing the students from achieving to their ability and preventing teachers from teaching. And I believe that some of the cultural change that we've initiated and maintained has contributed to a very, very different environment.
Let's go back to what was pretty much the closing stages of the last term in 2009 when you kicked off the White Ribbon Day program. Tell me about the activities that surrounded it and the students and the way they related to it.
Okay. Well, as part of the pilot program, Ray Pooley, our previous principal, brought White Ribbon and the idea to the school, and the staff discussed our involvement and then looked to the children to see what sort of things we could do to become involved. The first activity was actually it followed on from class discussions, and each class contributed in the way of some artwork, a white dove from the classrooms and some smaller white doves and ribbons that the children prepared after classroom discussions, and they were placed right along our front fence in a very highly visible area for passing traffic. There was an assembly to go with that, and the program kicked off, and from there it's become an integral part of our school environment, our student wellbeing programs, and really our ethos of encouraging respectful relationships is very, very strong and very much part of that White Ribbon involvement.
Now, while the program's been a success, you guys were on the front foot on this. Was there any blowback regarding the age of the students and overtly bringing up subjects like violence, domestic violence, and the kind of dysfunctional relationships that were being manifest in the schoolyard?
Well, I think all of the activities that we've developed and carried out have been age appropriate. And given that we've got students from 5 to 12, domestic violence itself isn't very often part of the conversations that we have. Ours is geared more around encouraging respectful relationships between all members of the community. Our staff certainly model respectful relationships in all of their interactions, and we expect the same from students and from parents. And it's really basically that general approach of being respectful towards each other. And students are spending 6 hours a day with us, and it's a very big part of their life at the moment. And modelling that behaviour and being involved in a safe and secure environment where that's expected and students have a right to feel safe and respected, we believe that, you know, that's providing a good grounding and a good platform for a start.
And this program certainly wasn't a bolt-on, was it? It permeated all levels of your education there at the school, and it came both from the teachers in the way that the student welfare and discipline policy was engaged, as well as from the kids creating their own anti-bullying policy.
That's correct. In 2009, when the department mandated schools to develop their own anti-bullying policies, this was perfect timing for us. And on the back of developing our anti-bullying policy, we then moved the following year to revamping our student wellbeing policy. And that's been a huge influence on the positive nature of the changes to our environment and the cultural changes. And part of the anti-bullying policy was developing the Bully Buster program, which is a peer mediation program that's become very, very, it's an integral part of our playground, and it's really contributed to a fantastic, more positive environment in the playground. It's been well recognised. We've helped other schools out with developing similar programs. And once again, it's all very closely linked with White Ribbon, and our ethos of encouraging respectful relationships comes through in all areas.
So describe for those of us who don't have kids in a Bully Busters type program what that looks like.
Okay, we provide training for Stage 3 students, which are Year 5 and 6. In fact, as of this year, all of our Year 5 students have undergone that training. It's a formal training that we've, from a developed manual and videos that we've developed over the years. It basically gives the students the skills, the language and the strategies to be able to help deal with bullying issues in the playground, help out with minor conflict resolution. And the roles of the Bully Busters is really, the roles have expanded into refereeing games, supervising our passive play zones that we have in two areas of the school that give children who don't want to be out running around on a particular day some options such as craft and calmer games within a nice calm environment. And we've even got, I suppose, the culture towards the Bully Busters that's been amazing is the students really aspire. By the end of Year 4, they're aspiring because it's a very important part of our school leadership program. Apart from our school captains and prefects and house captains, the Bully Busters are now recognised as a very important leadership group within the school.
You speak about relationships covering the playground, but the teachers also use reference points for the program in things like maths and science and other curriculum areas, don't they?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, part of our anti-bullying policy that was introduced in 2010, the stage teams got together and developed age-appropriate anti-bullying policy. So that's part of our PDHPE curriculum, our personal development area. There's also been a lot of involvement through literacy in poetry writing and writing, especially for White Ribbon activities. Through visual arts, we've had students at work in visual arts being involved in exhibitions for White Ribbon and in other art exhibitions involved in, you know, the school regions. And, you know, apart from that, just on a daily basis, when we were having roundtable resolutions meetings with students, White Ribbon is often referred to, and it is very much an integral part of the way that we resolve issues of playground conflict and friendship issues that we come across on a regular basis.
Given the program's been running for a little while now, what kind of anecdotal evidence has there been in community change as a result of the things that you've been doing in the school?
Well, I suppose community-wise, I believe that the parent community have been very much on board, and they're starting to see that resolving issues through correct channels and in a respectful manner is certainly the way to go. A few years ago, that wasn't always happening. I think probably at a school level, the reduction in suspensions that we had from the 2009 era has been dramatic, absolutely dramatic. And I suppose the students are now expecting to be able to walk out of that playground and be safe and happy in that environment. And that's, they know that that's their rights, and they're also they're very well aware of standing up and making a stand against bullying and reporting bullying through the correct channels, and that has really settled things down. So if an incident that we regard as reasonably serious comes to light, everything that is reported to us is followed through, and we believe that that gives the confidence in the community. They know that that we will deal with bullying issues, and we'll follow things up and move on from there.
I love the fact that this touches on all sectors of life in such a formative time of a child's development. That is, that I have the rights to safety. I have the rights to a space. I have the rights to be treated appropriately and respectfully. And I also really relish the prospect of teaching children at this age that there are really helpful ways to deal with anger, really helpful ways to deal with injustice, and they don't involve lashing out.
That's exactly right, and I think that our school's learning support team is very supportive in that area as well, and giving the children the language to manage playground conflict and bullying, and giving the children the strategies that comes out on, it's not just in term one when we deliver those 10 anti-bullying lessons at the beginning of the year, it comes up constantly. The teachers and the school executive, when they're following up with incidents and conflict within the playground, it's the language that we're using all the time is a common language, and the children are able to articulate that, and hopefully that will continue, and they're able to report to teachers and report to bully busters when they're feeling uncomfortable and when they do need some support with an incident or an issue.
Rob, congratulations on everything you're doing there at the school. Well done. Thanks for your time.
Thanks, Dwayne.